What is to you, what in your mind is the idea of the model minority?
Well, the idea of the model minority to me is a stereotype about Asian Americans in particular, though it sometimes applies to other groups and sometimes groups apply it to themselves. But particularly where Asian Americans are concerned, the model minority basically suggests that Asians by culture or in some instances even by biology have a greater disposition toward success, value education more, work hard, are quiet, uncomplaining, cooperative, and are willing to make sacrifices in order to achieve a better life. And, you know, it's hard to describe the model minority except in terms of what it's not. The model minority is not prone to criminality, not prone to protest, not disruptive, and willing to basically quietly work and do as they're told.
And based on your understanding of it and what you know, what you've learned about it, how did that idea form and take hold here in the United States?
Well, the historian Ellen Wu has looked at this question and basically locates the origins of the myth in the efforts of Japanese Americans and Chinese Americans to achieve assimilation right around the time of World War II. And so at a time when they were being persecuted terribly, Japanese Americans just returning from internment camps and the Chinese community being horribly persecuted in anti-communist campaigns, decided that they would try to present themselves as ideal Americans at a time when the U.S. needed foreign alliances, and particularly with China, and started to do what amounts to research to demonstrate that Asian Americans were less likely to commit crimes, worked hard, were actually upwardly mobile, and perfectly assimilable to the white middle class. And that research, which was primarily done under the auspices of the Japanese American Citizens League, eventually took on a life of its own. It received major funding support from institutions like the Carnegie Foundation. It was also housed for a time at the University of California, Los Angeles. And all of this research basically amounted to, in terms of any kind of popular, readership for the findings, in a book called Nisei, The Quiet Americans. And that's the template for the model minority. Now, what we know is that much was suppressed in terms of what life was really like within the Asian ghettos in the United States. And a lot of sort of cherry picking was done in order to be able to present an idea about Asian Americans and Japanese Americans in particular.
Cherry picking by whom at this time?
Well, cherry picking basically by the research team. And in order to exclude certain things, you know, the problems of, juvenile delinquency, for example, in Asian American ghettos, of zoot suiters in Asian American communities, people who did not conform with the white middle class ideal were basically put out of the picture. And instead, an image of Asian Americans was presented as studious and quiet, hardworking, and law-abiding. And being really, as I said, perfectly assimilable to the white middle class.
Would it be accurate if I were to observe that and call that, you know, for whatever after effects there have been, an act of self-preservation in a way? Or
yeah, it was absolutely an act of self-preservation. We have to understand the context for this. The anti-communist campaigns that were waged against the Chinese American community were horrible in terms of a kind of persecution that people face, the kind of spying and pressure that people were put under, deportations even. In the Japanese American community, almost the entire community on the U.S. mainland was interned during World War II, almost to a person. And so people understood that they were hated minorities and needed some way to leverage their way into the American mainstream.
And at what point... Excuse me. So in terms of timeline here, you're talking, you said right after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, right, millions of Japanese Americans have been interned or have been, rounded up, and How does that idea, sort of just kind of tracing the formation of this idea and how it's changed over time, you know, one of the issues you'd brought up with Dime and Helen was the effect of 1965.
Mm-hmm.
What happens to this idea in the 1960s?
Well, in the 1960s, this idea of Asian Americans as a model minority is picked up by conservative media and by conservative politicians, and is used as an argument for against civil rights for African Americans, basically, and particularly not the idea of civil rights or legal inclusion, but particularly programs to help to resolve the legacy of racial inequality faced by African Americans in that period. So programs like busing and affirmative action, for instance. And so the case is made through talking about specifically at first the Japanese American community, that this is a community that was horribly persecuted, that started out in poverty, and within a couple of generations is now assimilating to the white middle class, has integrated itself into middle class suburbs and communities around America, and is enjoying an average family income that is comparable to that of middle class families in the United States, regardless of race.
And that argument, I mean, I implied in that, and I want to spell this out, implied in that argument is that they came from poverty, or they came from difficult circumstances, and they worked their way out of it, thus maybe fulfilling a particular version of, you know, a particular subset of American values, which is to say, mm-hmm. if you work hard, you can make it, and people, and by extension, people who aren't in difficult circumstances need to work harder.
Well, essentially what happens is that Japanese Americans are presented as the heroes in a kind of Horatio Alger-like story of American social mobility. They are the exceptions that prove the rule. And the argument is we live in a colorblind society. You may face various different kinds of obstacles to success, but hard work will resolve those obstacles, that you can overcome anything if you're willing to make the sacrifices necessary in order to do so. And that African Americans in particular are unwilling to make those sacrifices and just expect that those things will be given to them.
And so what happens then? So I'm trying to observe sort of the arc of this. On the one hand, towards the beginning, you have this idea coming up to sort of help Japanese Americans mm-hmm. preserve themselves. So, you know, if they see this is where, you know, if you want to preserve ourselves, this is where we need to assimilate. And so there research, as you were saying, pushing it in that direction. And then, as I understand it, in the 60s, it's woven into this bigger myth of American mm-hmm. social mobility. And as a lever or as a story to prove that African Americans just need to work harder. So what happens then to the ways that, I mean, painting in broad brushes, I guess, but once that idea enters the narrative of American social mobility, what happens to the actual relations between, I guess in this case, we're talking about East Asian Americans and mm-hmm. African Americans? Because now we know what conservatives are saying about two uh-huh. different groups, but what actually happens between the different groups?
Well, you know, it's not a simple cause and effect kind of story. What we have to understand is that there have always been tensions between African Americans and Asians, and particularly Asian immigrants. There is a long tradition of Black Orientalism. Just as there is a tradition of Orientalism in the United States in general, treating Asian Americans as perpetual foreigners in order to make an argument about citizenship inclusion for other groups of people, especially African Americans.
So when you say Black Orientalism, do you mean the idea of Orientalism also existed among Black community here? Or I guess what did you mean by that exactly?
Let me see if I can put this another way. There's always been tension between Asian and African-American peoples in the United States. This is something that goes all the way back to the period immediately post the Civil War, when Asian and particularly Chinese coolies are brought to the United States as workers. They're viewed as competition by white workers, who therefore make an argument against them based upon their exclusion from citizenship. Meanwhile, African Americans, who have always been excluded from citizenship, are trying to make an argument for citizenship, some of them, by comparing themselves to Asian Americans and saying, these people here seem to be on a track to be able to get to citizenship. They're going to court trying to win the right to become citizens. But we've been here longer. We were here first. And we deserve to be included in citizenship before those people. And so this is not necessarily a majority opinion, but this is the way in which this argument got framed. And it contributes to this idea of Asian Americans as the perpetual foreigners in the United States. There is a way in which these two arguments, one by white workers and the other by African-American intellectual class that is trying to argue for citizenship, that basically changes the meaning of race in the United States so that it hardens the idea of citizenship being associated with white race in a way that was legally, in fact, the way that we understood citizenship, but without a foil, without an other against which to hone that identity, it was not as clear. So at this point, it becomes extraordinarily clear. And the status of Asian Americans in the United States has always been affected by that. We're always considered the foreign other, which is what makes it possible for something like model minority stereotyping to happen. I mean, when you think about the model minority stereotype, it posits some ridiculous ideas about people. Human beings don't function like that. They aren't born more naturally prone to be good at math. They're not prone to be born prone to be better at particular skills, particularly technical skills. People are not, by culture in the Asian American community, less likely to commit crime. There is no Asian culture. There is no singular Asian culture at all. And the category Asian is a construct that is developed within the context of the United States, here Asian American, that doesn't apply to Asians in the countries from which they come. We're talking about a population today in the United States that is, you know, 75% or so foreign-born. So they come here without any concept of themselves as Asians and then are confronted with this idea that not only are they Asian now, but that they fit into this model minority stereotype that suggests that we all share one cultural basis for the ways in which we behave. That's the way that race has always worked. The categories come first, the distinctions come later in order to justify the existence of the categories.
Do you think, though, then, you know, and you're making a strong argument here that an argument here that there's no Asian culture and that these ideas that there are natural predispositions that are embedded in Asian culture, however you define it, like you said, categories come first. Do you think then, I mean, you know, I don't want to paint with too broad a brush here, but what accounts for that idea taking hold amongst Asian Americans themselves? Or do you think it's primarily a construct imposed by white supremacy? I'm trying to, you know, where does the category take hold among people ourselves? Because I would call myself Asian, even if that's a strange category in some mm-hmm. ways, you know.
Well, Asian in the United States today is something I understand as a political coalition. It is a coalition amongst different Asian ethnic minority groups in the United States in order to be able to exercise political power by reaching critical mass and being able to therefore then even argue for disaggregation of that group and attention be paid to specific needs of particular groups like war refugees, for example. But in order for us to get to that argument, we need the coalition. The coalition is something that is rooted in the 60s. And the fight for ethnic studies in the University of California campuses. That particular, you know, fight for ethnic studies is one in which the term Asian American is coined. Until then, in popular parlance, Asian Americans are Orientals.
And, sorry, I just take a moment to see if I can close the door, because I think we were talking. There was a moment there toward the end of your explanation that where I could hear like a little bit of okay. sound coming from the door. But getting back to the idea of, it seems like what you're describing is taking a category that was imposed from the outside or maybe helped created by self-preservation mm-hmm. and then imposed from the outside and transforming it into a unit of organization and transforming a category into a coalition. So what can be, could you tell me, give me some examples of, you were just talking about it before I cut you off, the Movement for Ethnic Studies in California. Mm-hmm. What are some moments or examples of that coalition building that you're talking about?
Well, the coalition building around Asian American identity is something that's always happening. There are many different national formations that are pan-Asian. Some include Pacific Islanders, some don't. Some attempt to reach out as far as to Native Hawaiians and to create an even broader coalition. But that coalition building process is one that has been an ongoing process since the 1960s. And it's taken on a number of different meanings because the political context has changed a lot since then. But it's never stopped.
And what are the implications for that coalition building in terms of how Asian Americans, and at which point you're taking that term and using it to organize for political change? What are the implications of that for how Asian Americans see themselves in relation to African Americans, given that we've been used as a lever in a story about American social mobility?
Well,
I guess to you, I'm not mm-hmm. saying like an objective assessment.
Well, I think that the Asian American coalition is a necessary but problematic thing in American political life. It's problematic to the extent that it concedes to the idea that there is a singular Asian identity and political agenda that we can, you know, craft out of the diverse experiences of people from as, different in terms of background as Japanese and Laotian. You know, Laos being a mostly rural country with one of the lowest life expectancies in the world, and Japan being an almost entirely urban society that has the highest life expectancy in the world. These are the kinds of challenges that we face when we try to lump people together in that way. But every attempt to build a class with class interests is going to be confronted with those challenges. And in the United States, race is class and always has been. And so, there's really no distinction, no real clear distinction between race and class in the United States. It doesn't mean that race class is impermeable, that, you know, people must therefore always have that reflected in their economic experience. You know, there is an Oprah and a Denzel and, you know, people of that sort who have been successful. But that's also true of white working class people. No class is impermeable. There's always some amount of mobility. And so, those contradictions between the way that we do business and the way that we run our society in terms of, you know, democratic participation get reflected in those exceptions being, evident throughout society. But, you know, let me try to get back onto the question.
Yeah. So, actually, do you mind if just real quick, I find this mic keeps on tilting.
Mm-hmm.
Do you mind just moving a little bit closer to the mic? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Good. Thanks. Appreciate it.
So, okay. So
you're talking about the idea of race as class. It always has been.
Yeah. So let me see how we can go back around to this thing, because it is a complicated idea and I think that people will get lost in it. So the Asian American political coalition should be understood as a political coalition. When it starts to be understood as a form of identity, it becomes problematic. But, what we should be thinking about in terms of the coalition building process is to try to understand who is this class of people, Asian Americans, because in the United States, race has always been class. There's never been any distinction. When we look at white working class people, for example, there is a racial meaning to that identity, because it is understood relative to or in comparison to the experiences of other people by race. You see that kind of rage reflected in, the Donald Trump base, right? Their understanding of class and race are inseparable. They go together. So, I think that when you're trying to build a political agenda based upon a, kind of classification like Asian American, that's a really thorny process and one that's rife with all kinds of potential problems.
Yeah. What kind of potential problems are you talking about?
Well, one of the potential problems is that we start to focus so much on the distinctions between Asian Americans and others that we forget the category is entirely synthetic.
unpack that for a moment. You mean, well, what's like an, what's an example of how first, sure
the people sure. came after, yeah. right?
But and what's so, what's an example of Asian Americans getting caught up in unpacking that while losing sight of the fact that, as you say, that category is a synthetic creation?
Well, for instance, there is a lot of discussion of Asian privilege. That privilege does not apply uniformly to everyone who's Asian American. There are groups by ethnicity within the United States and by class within the United States who do not enjoy that kind of privilege in the same way that some others may. And so, you know, there's this way in which we think of Asian Americans as an aggregate as being better off than other groups, which, if you look at us as an aggregate, is true. But the reality is that it doesn't necessarily apply to the individual experiences of people within the category, right, within that aggregated group. And so it has the effect of causing us to look at those distinctions at the expense of making the categories appear to be natural. So, for example, the Asian American model minority myth has this effect, right? People will say, when you look at Asian Americans, they have the highest average per capita income and the highest median family incomes of all groups in the United States. There are a lot of different reasons for that that have nothing to do with individual achievement, but some of it does, in fact, have to do with the characteristics of the most dominant groups within the Asian American coalition because of the way that immigration sorts people. For a long time now, U.S. industry has targeted Asia and professional class workers in Asia to bring them to the United States, and that has gentrified Asian America, causing those aggregate statistics to rise really dramatically. Asians are the most likely to come to the United States with a college degree and a worker sponsor, for instance. So people come here already having been educated, already being in a professional class kind of situation in their home countries, are not at all reflective of what the aggregate experiences of people, say, in India or Japan or China or wherever else they may be from. But here, that aggregate being synthetic as it is, those groups of people who have been recruited here as business investors and highly skilled professional workers end up causing the aggregate statistics to look much higher, right? So that reality, which is then exploited by those who promulgate this myth of the Asian American model minority as a kind of lever of racial inequity, that is something that people tend to focus on in a way that makes the category Asian seem natural. If we thought of the category as synthetic, then none of the distinctions within the category actually mean anything but politics.
Hmm. Is the model, idea of the model minority an American idea?
It is a particularly American idea to think of groups in terms of model minority. Race, as we understand it in the United States, is a peculiarly American institution. One that was invented in order to justify race slavery as a solution to the colonial project in North America, which was not viable without highly exploited labor. And so, the whole idea of race is one that originally is justified by ideas about culture and biology that were not actually things that people understood prior to, the age of slavery in the United States and around that time. It's a very recent phenomena, and in the United States is a particularly American character to white supremacy.
Hmm. Right, and those categories inextricably are linked to white supremacy, which are heavily rooted in America's own history and its... And like you said earlier, America couldn't have been built up into what it is without exploited labor. Because I'm wondering too, if is this just an American idea? Is it a Western idea? Where has this idea? Are there examples in other countries of a similar kind of myth being created about a group of people? And then also by way of comparison, like how do you move past that? Are you? I know most of your work is primarily centered here in the U.S., but are there examples you can think of where Asian Americans, or not Asian Americans, I guess, but people from Asia have like a similar moniker or similar label attached to them, and how might other countries have dealt with this if they have?
Well, there's been a diaspora from particularly from South Asia, that has affected places like Australia and Fiji and New Zealand. And there is a tremendous amount of resentment that seems to be building up there. Again, what we're looking at is a group of people who are being pushed out or moving out of the Indian subcontinent and other places in South Asia, largely as a result of instability, political unrest, and economic difficulties there, but who have the capacity to be able to rise to kind of middle-class economic status. And so there is a way in which people regard people who are Asian in those contexts as if they are like a model minority. What is unusual about the United States is that the United States imposes codes, or has historically done so. And those codes, the living legacy of racial codes, right, overt racist laws, is still with us today in the way that they have basically informed the organization of our cities. Right, where are ghettos and who occupies them? Where are suburbs and who occupies those? You know, and in the way that we understand and regard one another, others may see difference, but what they don't see that we see is race.
We being Americans.
Yes. For example, in the Philippines, there is tremendous resentment toward the Chinese. Right, because there is an investor class of Chinese immigrants in the Philippines who are part of this sort of emerging neoliberal economy in the Philippines that is causing incredible hardship for the Filipino people. The Filipino people don't regard the Chinese as Asian. They regard them as Chinese. Right. Similarly, in Fiji, Indians are not regarded as Asian. They're regarded as Indians.
Right. And in Singapore... I mean, in Singapore, it's not like the Chinese majority doesn't regard the Malay and Indian minorities as Asians because everyone's Asian.
Mm-hmm.
Asian seems to be a particularly unique Western, if not American, category.
Yeah. Asian is, Asian is rooted in an old tradition of Orientalism that comes out of Europe that is about colonization and exploitation of Asia, particularly China. Right. And India. And it is an idea that is, you know, as old as the idea of the Occident. Right. The Occident and the Orient go together. Over time, though, it's taken on many different meanings. And in the United States context, it's taken on a particularly racial one.
Where do you think we are now? What's your assessment of what do you think the future of this idea is, of the model minority myth? Is in the U.S.
Well, you know, I think that right now a lot of people are challenging the model minority myth. Asian Americans themselves, in fact, particularly the new generation of Asian American activists that is rising into leadership now, have made it a project to, to fight against that kind of stereotyping, to make the case that that kind of stereotyping is a lever of racial inequality and dehumanizing to Asian Americans.
So in your mind, it seems like... And does that kind of activism pushing back strike you? Like, what's new about it compared to previous waves of activism?
Well, there have been waves of activism throughout our history since the 60s against this idea of the Asian American model minority that's led by Asian Americans themselves. I think today the difference is that what people are reaching for is a kind of solidarity politic that would join together Asian Americans with other people of color in order to challenge white supremacy in the United States. And so there's a lot of promise there. I think, though, that when we think about Black and Asian solidarity, we have to be careful, right? We tend to focus on those exceptional instances in which Black and Asian people have risen up in solidarity with one another in American history. Those instances are significant. And the people who led the charge in those times were exceptional people, but they are the exception, not the rule, right? There's a danger of focusing on those exceptions as if they are indicative of some natural basis for solidarity, when in fact there is no real natural basis for solidarity. The basis for solidarity is political, right? We need to arrive at a politic that supports that kind of solidarity and attack not try to emulate the exceptional situation so much as to attack what is normative, right? Which is disunity, not unity.
Mm-hmm. So those are the exception and not the rule. Mm-hmm. So what's the rule then?
Well, throughout most of history, Asian Americans and African Americans have not stood up with each other, right? Asian Americans in particular have tried to make the argument for citizenship historically by basically arguing that they aren't black, right? So, you know, when we talk about race in the United States, race and citizenship always go together, right? Race, class, and citizenship always go together. And so the fight for inclusion is a fight for citizenship rights. It is that even amongst undocumented immigrants today. Undocumented immigrants are a class of workers in the United States that are increasingly raced as Mexican and Latino more broadly. That transformation of, you know, our way of understanding migrant workers as a race, as opposed to, you know, ethnic groups coming to the United States from neighboring countries, is something that we should be paying attention to. Because what's happening here is that Latinos basically, or undocumented immigrants, I should say, have, by being held in this sort of state of, you know, exclusion from any possibility of citizenship rights, been made into a highly exploitable class of workers. They are in all of the same industries that black people used to be in before the 60s, right? Domestic work, agriculture, light manufacturing, construction trades. They've basically replaced African American workers in those industries because they are so exploitable, right? And so the industries themselves did not have to respond to African Americans winning the right to inclusion under U.S. labor laws. Instead, has turned to a new pool of laborers. That's the way that race and class work in the United States, and always has worked that way. It's a seamless story that begins with slavery, and it's continuing today. The constant fight: who gets to be an American? Why do they get to be Americans, and what does that mean, is one that we're fighting about in this election season. It's one that we're fighting about when we talk about immigration rights. It's one that we're fighting over when we talk about police brutality directed against African Americans. At the heart of that struggle is an idea about citizenship. Do we belong to a civic nation, or do we belong to an ethnic one? Do we, you know, are we going to include people in citizenship? Or are we going to exclude people? And what are the implications of that?
And why you're saying, and why do we, it's flu season. And why do we exclude some people and not others? And you were talking about, you know, you had said undocumented workers before that, you had said Latinos, and you corrected yourself. And you were just talking about the intermingling, or perhaps the equivalence of race and class. And I'm reminded of actually, this is journalist Jose Antonio Vargas, who is an undocumented immigrant. He's Filipino, but mm-hmm. if you check his Twitter account, he gets so much hate, so much anti-Mexican, anti-Latino rhetoric. Mm-hmm. Just the amount of times he said, you know, it's just like, go back to, you know, it can be, you know, it's not benign, but it's like, go back to Mexico, which is the mm-hmm. least profanity-laden version of that I've seen. Right, because white working class equals this. We have this image of white working class voter, or working, even just working class, as being primarily white, and then undocumented immigrant equals Latino.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the whole idea that undocumented immigrants are Mexican in particular is one that we've been fighting over for a very long time now. But, you know, there is this kind of odd way in which that idea of Mexican, which is a nationality, has become like a race to us, that also is, you know, is probably best articulated through in the term illegal immigrant, right? It basically says that a group of people in the United States who have done nothing but commit a misdemeanor by being here without documentation are a criminal class, are in fact illegal. When the reality is that, you know, U.S. industry would come to a screeching halt in many sectors were it not for Latino laborers. We've seen examples of this over and over again. You know, the Washington apple industry a few years ago basically lost an enormous amount of money. Apples were just falling up from the trees unpicked because of immigration raids keeping workers at home. Nobody else wants those jobs because they're structured in terms of wages and working conditions in a way that reflects race as class.
I want to take a minute and pivot towards your own experience with, perhaps not with, it also maybe narrowed down a little bit because there's a lot of, you know, we've talked about race and citizenship and history and the way, you know, the way particular ideas have moved around and taken hold. But when you were growing up, did you see yourself as a model minority?
Well, when I was growing up, I did not see myself as a model minority because I in no way embodied the characteristics of the model minority. You know, I grew up in Hawaii. And so first of all, growing up in Hawaii, I did not think of myself as Asian. Asians were people who lived on the U.S. mainland. Right, they were people who lived on the continent. We even had an expression we would use for Asian Americans from the continent. We would refer to them as katonk. It's the sound that their heads make when they hit the floor because there's nothing in there, is what we would say, right? Because our identity was as working class people. That is how we thought of ourselves. We were rooted in a long tradition of labor and labor organizing. We voted Democratic across the board with no exceptions.
Who's we in this case?
Who we think of as Asian Americans in Hawaii. So in Hawaii, where I grew up, people identify by ethnicity, not by, you know, Asian race. So people are Japanese or Chinese or Korean or Filipino. They are not a group of people who identify with one another as a single group of people by race. And that's actually true of most people in Asia as well, by the way. But there is a kind of a class identity that people who are the descendants of Asian immigrants in Hawaii have assumed. And that class identity is rooted in the history of Hawaii as a white Republican oligarchy. It was ruled from the top down at the expense of Native Hawaiians and immigrant workers for generations. The effort to push back against that and win democratic rights for people is one in which there were many efforts that failed because they were organized by ethnicity. It was when people started to think of themselves as a class of people and united across ethnicities that those efforts started to succeed. So, for example, Hawaii has the first organized agricultural workforce in sugar, right? Sugar is gone from Hawaii now, but, you know, for a long time, sugar ruled the Hawaiian economy. The way in which that labor organizing effort became successful was people started out forming ethnic unions that failed and then finally came together and formed a class union that united them across ethnicities that succeeded. The one thing that you could say about that class, though, is that it was entirely brown. There were no white people in that class. And that's the foundation for a kind of way that people think of themselves as Hawaii as locals who are not white and born in Hawaii, or not born in Hawaii, but adopted by people who identify as locals. That group includes Native Hawaiians, but not necessarily to the greater benefit of Native Hawaiians, because Native Hawaiians have specific needs. There is a specific status politically that Native Hawaiians assume that local identity does not actually address substantively. But that's the context in which I grew up. So I thought of myself as a local kid. And I didn't think much about ethnicity, actually. I grew up in a multiracial setting in a very rural and working class community. We always voted Democrat. We did whatever the union told us to do on our ballots. We thought of ourselves as working class people and were proud of that. And, you know, so that's how I grew up. But, you know, I also was a gay kid, you know, and I, recognized that I was never really going to be included. And I reacted to that and, you know, got into a lot of trouble. And, you know, so I was always in and out of school and occasionally failing and whatnot. So I just never fit that model minority stereotype. The thing that is really telling about my experience, though, is that whether or not I fit that stereotype, the stereotype did, to an extent, apply to me because of my Japanese surname, right? I hung out with a group of people among whom I was the only one, perhaps, for a long time that had a Japanese surname. And we would all get in trouble together. I often was the mastermind, right? I came up with the plot. The point at which we would be punished, though, I would be excluded from the worst forms of punishment because it was always assumed that I was influenced by other people, right? I was under the bad influence of other groups of people and that I had a kind of potential to succeed because it was simply assumed that I had a stable family life, which is actually, again, not a true thing.
Right. Yeah, it was assumed you were under a bad influence. You had a lot of potential, and you were actually good, like a quote unquote good kid. And it's these are mm-hmm. hanging out with the bad kids, so we don't want to ruin these kids.
Yeah, specifically, chances. Bad kids were Filipinos, Samoans, Hawaiians. You know, anybody that didn't have a Japanese or Chinese surname.
When did This is interesting because you've described a particularly, like, on one hand, a very unique set of, or I guess compared to what is normative on the continent when it comes to Asian Americans and how they're seen, in describing how you grew up in Hawaii, but even within that, there's implications for, you know, you mentioned because of your last name is Japanese, so there are certain assumptions. Based on what, you know, on what kind of kid you were, what kind of person you were growing up. At what point did you, so you grew up in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. At what point did you come to, I guess, the mainland and how did that idea, you described a few instances where that idea of the model minority, even if you didn't fit it, it still shaped your life in some ways. How did that continue going forward when you started working here in the mainland?
Well, I mean, that idea of the model minority actually helped me all the way through my life. I didn't always have an awareness of it, but it was always there somewhere. So, you know, I'm a person who dropped in and out of high school and basically failed high school. And I don't have a college degree, but it's often assumed that I do have one. And so it's not questioned, right? If I can adopt the right accent and I can use the right words, it's simply assumed that I'm a highly educated person. And then, you know, certain opportunities are made available to me that aren't made to others. And I have come to recognize that one of the things that triggers that response in people is who they see when they look at me, right? But when I came here to the U.S. mainland, it was a really difficult time for East Asians on the continent, and particularly because of the context of the U.S.-Japan Auto Wars.
This is the 1980s?
This is the 1980s, yes. So I came over here in 1985, I believe. And in the context of the U.S.-Japan Auto Wars, it was rough. You know, there was a lot of resentment. And I particularly remember one instance in Corvallis, Oregon, walking down Fraternity Row and having these fraternity boys throw half-empty beer cans at me and tell me to go back where I came from. You know, it was that kind of time in the United States. And so, you know, it was both an advantage and a disadvantage to me. I remember accompanying a food stamp recipient to the food stamp office to resolve a problem with her, you know, food stamp allotment. And having them basically assume that she was there to translate for me, in spite of the fact that I'm speaking to them in English as I'm speaking to you now. So, you know, there were a lot of those kinds of things that happened in the 80s. And but, you know, it's always been a thing that has cloaked me in a certain kind of idea about innocence and achievement, education, you know, a lot of different things.
Yeah. And that was new to you when you at that particular brand of being the other or being foreign. Was that mm-hmm. a new thing for you? You came to the United?
When I first moved from Hawaii to Portland, Oregon, I was just shocked. You know, Hawaii is, you know, a state that is organized as a racial hierarchy. You know, there's no doubt about it. There is a kind of white supremacy that is evident in Hawaii. But on the ground, people of color are the majority. And in the communities I lived in, not just the majority. I mean, there was only one white kid in my high school graduating class. And so when you're in the majority in that way, the peculiar circumstances of your history, your experiences, your family background are treated as normative, right? We established what was normal in the communities that where we were able to dominate. I came here and suddenly I was the other. I frankly would walk into meetings of progressive organizations that were predominantly white and just be shocked at what I thought was just the most incredible racism and ethnocentrism. I had no idea that those slights were not intended.
What's an example of that? I want to take a slight detour in this direction because I know that, you know, part of what we've talked about and part of your expertise and also in your own background, your background you provided around the proliferation of the model minority myth is a lot of it is centered on, as you said, sort of conservative media, conservative ideas, right-wing media. What do you mean then when you say you walked into, I guess, you know, coming into Portland, Oregon, you're sort of in a collision course with white, with sort of progressive politics in a certain vein and also an overwhelmingly white city. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a bit more about what you mean by that when you've described those experiences?
Well, people would talk about people of color as if we were objects and as if we were minorities. And there seemed to be a lack of awareness that white people have a kind of race-defined identity as well. And as a dominant group, there are certain characteristics that white people have that play out, particularly when people start to be to take action politically. And so it was that lack of awareness that everyone has an identity. For example, when people would say we need more diversity, what they would always mean is that we needed more people of color, right? It was the idea that you had to bring others in to a group in order to diversify a group that was just an odd idea to me. It just, you know, I mean, I had never encountered anything quite like it, and I just assumed that that kind of tokenization was intentional and not, you know, the accident of, you know, well-intentioned people trying to, you know, do a positive thing.
Hmm. And so you describe, I want to back up towards both your experience in Hawaii and then coming to Oregon. You know, I was thinking back to this conversation on, because I actually grew up in Hong Kong. And there were probably, I think there were two black kids in my entire high school. They're both African Americans. I didn't know, I don't think there were any Africans in my school. And so I'm curious, in your own experience, like how were you raised with, whether explicitly or implicitly, particular ideas of African Americans I guess that's the question. Like, were you raised with any particular notions of what African Americans were like, or what black folks, if black folks had any particular traits or things like that?
Well, you know, I grew up in a place. I grew up split between two communities. One was a community where there was still active sugar plantation, and where the economy wasn't entirely rooted in sugar, but where that was the tradition. It was part of a 20-year process that community was going in which it was the economy was transitioning out of sugar and into tourism. And so, you know, I grew up in that place, and in that place, there were very few African Americans, and it just wasn't something that ever occurred to us. We didn't think about it. This wasn't part of our day-to-day reality. In the community that my parents lived in, they live surrounded on all sides by military bases.
Where did the parents grow up?
My parents, my mother still lives in a town in the middle of the island of Oahu. that is surrounded by military bases. Schofield Barracks, Wheeler Air Force Base, Navy 85, the East Range, which is a kind of, you know, one of these military training grounds. It was a community whose economy was driven by the military. And so the town was full of hostess bars and fast food restaurants. And, you know, on military payday, there would be enormous numbers of people in the streets, often 18 and 19-year-old soldiers. And a disproportionate number of those soldiers who were, you know, out in the community on military paydays were Black. And so my parents developed a really negative attitude toward African-Americans and white people, both, because that's who she mostly saw represented in the military. And, you know, that odd kind of view of a group of people who are otherwise foreign to you filtered through the military so that these are people who are living on barracks in a pressure cooker kind of situation, going through basic training, who are released occasionally into the community with money in their pockets. And the community is one that's organized such that there are hostess bars everywhere and, you know, a kind of a economy that reflects this low wages and incredibly pressurized lifestyle of people who are going to be living on a military base. And so the lethal mix of all of that stuff, the confrontations between local people and soldiers, came to inform their understanding of what African Americans were like. And they shared those ideas with me and my sisters, who I'm sure internalized some of them and rejected others of them because we grew up during the years of the Civil Rights Movement. And so in our generation, we had seen something quite different start to unfold and had the basis to challenge some of those ideas. But they were still new ideas to us.
Hmm. What does, I think, so it's about 1202. So one, maybe I'll ask a couple more questions and we can wrap it up. But, you know, one of the tropes that I've, one of the themes that I've noticed in a lot of these conversations, and you had alluded to it as you were talking about your upbringing compared to your parents' upbringing, is this idea of, if not challenging what your parents thought, having some kind of conversation. Mm-hmm. I feel like, I think a big trope between, I guess, Asian Americans between themselves is talking about their families. But, and whether you see this with, you know, I think it was after... I mean, it's sad that I can't remember which shooting of an unarmed Black man this was. I think it was Alton Sterling. There was a crowd, a sort of Asian Americans on the internet sort of gathered to craft like a letter to their families about Black Lives Matter that was translated into different languages. And then I think one of the topics that came up during the Epano panel and the discussions, especially because the group I was in was skewed much younger, was I have these political, you know, I was raised with these ideas about the model minority myth and African Americans and how I relate to them. And I have these ideas, but my parents don't have the ideas. And there are various reasons why there's this sort of communication gap, whether it's in some cases language, in other cases, one thing I heard was, you know, I feel like my parents gave up so much to come here. So why would I place an added burden onto them to try to care about another group of people? Which is, all of this is a long kind of prelude to this last idea I want to kind of explore with you and ask you about, which is, you know, what needs to happen within, maybe not even, and you can choose whatever unit of group you want to decide here, because you can talk as big as like a political coalition or as small as like a family or between two people. How do Asian Americans, number one, sort of get rid of the idea of the model minority, and then number two, build solidarity and support with African Americans. And you know, that's a long-winded way of asking that question, but I wanted to couch it in that particular backdrop because it's I've seen a lot of bits and pieces of that in when people tell their stories is how did their how do ideas pass down between their families and how do they relate to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think that the way that we should address the model minority is as a story about labor. You know, basically what the model minority has done is class Asian Americans is highly exploitable managerial class laborers, right? Wage earners, not owners. And, you know, with the kinds of characteristics that make you perfectly exploitable, you don't complain, you don't protest, you're quiet, you're cooperative, you work really hard, you allow your identity to be as subsumed within the goals of the group, right? Really good team players with technical skills and proficiency and a really low error rate, right? I mean, that's basically what the model minority amounts to. And so for, you know, people who are Asian American, I think one of the things that we need to understand is that what that means is, or appears to mean is, or one apparent consequence of that is that Asian Americans are also the least likely group once hired to be promoted into executive management, right? Because those are not the characteristics of leaders. Those are the characteristics of followers, right? And so when people are being told, this is the model minority, you should emulate it, what they're basically saying is, be a really good follower, be a perfectly exploitable worker. So I think that if we can talk about it as a story about labor, it starts to make sense. Because we hear people, the echoes of the model minority myth in the immigration debate, for example, where people who are advocating for Latino undocumented immigrants will describe them as hardworking and law-abiding and, you know, all of these different things, which may be true of many, many of them, right? But as a shield against the kind of exploitation that they have been facing is not very effective. And that's something I think the Asian American experience teaches us. We have to remember that 3/4 of Asian Americans came to this country, are foreign-born. Most of the people who are in this country who are Asian American came after 1965 when we got immigration reform. And so we're talking about a highly filtered group of people. The story of people pulling themselves up by their bootstraps and rising through the class structure of the United States is not really the way it worked, right? So I think that that's one of the things that we can do. In terms of solidarity, I think what's really important to recognize is that race is class in the United States. And so all of our class interests rests on our ability to address the problem of race. The kind of economic precarity and the kind of economic difficulties that Americans are facing in this global economy, particularly in the age of neoliberalism, those challenges are challenges that have to do with how we relate to capital, right? And the way that capital has always addressed, people by race is to simply, basically color code class as a way of being able to keep people outside of citizenship, right? So, that's one way of approaching it.
Right.
I'll give you another, something simpler. What I think that in terms of solidarity we need to do is that we need to recognize that those instances when Asians and African Americans and other people of color have risen up together are exceptional moments in U.S. history. Most of the time, that's not what's happening. Most of the time, there's disunity, dissension, and tension, right? That's the normal state of things. And so we should be focusing not so much on the exceptional, which are, you know, circumstances that are often created by history, right? The historical accidents of those times, but on what's normal and try to understand what holds us in this state of disunity. What are the tropes and stereotypes and beliefs? What are the ways in which we understand our self-interests that keep us in this state of constant tension?
And seeing and shifting, yeah, shifting the focus, shifting the frame onto something that maybe is not quite as, not quite as exciting or doesn't pop as much.
Well, if you were to ask people in my family why African Americans are in the state that they're in, not as an entire group of people, but why there's disproportionate poverty and incarceration rates that are suffered by African Americans, one of the things they would say is that's because of black-on-black crime, which is a total trope, right? The whole idea of black-on-black crime, it's not a useful way of understanding crime at all. It is not also the typical experience, right? Most black people, even in the most, crime-filled, low-income neighborhoods, are not committing any crimes at all in the context That's something. That's a really big effort, right? To keep yourself, let me put that another way. Most people in, you know, low-income African-American communities are not committing crimes. And so to say that the reason is black-on-black crime is basically just a racist justification for poverty, right? And so I think that those are the kinds of places where there is opportunity for us to engage people in the Asian American community and talk about those things. Talk about the idea, for example, that African Americans are more naturally athletic. These are all tropes, right? These are all just stereotypes. There is actually no basis in fact for any of these things, particularly because there's no basis in fact, except for historical fact, for race. It's not biological, it's not cultural, it's entirely synthetic, it's a political construct.
My last question on this, and then I'll let you go, is you were describing what your members of your family would say, and you said black on black crime, and you brought these examples that perhaps might be typical of, as indicators of any prejudice or tropes that Asian Americans might have of African Americans. So that explanation that you just gave me of black and on where the idea of black and black crime comes from, is that how you would approach that conversation with members of your own family, or would it be a slightly different tack? Like, how would you approach that?
Well, with members of my own family, I would just push back on that idea that black on black crime is the reason why there's so much policing and incarceration of black people, by simply pointing out to them that the policing that's going on in black communities now is not actually protecting the majority of people who live in those communities who are completely law-abiding. It in fact suggests that the people in those communities who may be committing crimes are a danger to the rest of us, right? This is the kind of thing that's revealed by the black unsolved murder rate, for instance. The black unsolved murder rate is astronomically high. When it is a black person who's the victim, the amount of resources invested in investigating those crimes, the amount of time and effort that's put into it, is extraordinarily different than if the victim is of any other group. Hmm. And so, you know, it just kind of helps us to see that the reality is that the policing regimes that we've imposed upon black people are policing regimes that we've imposed upon them because we're protecting ourselves from black communities, right? And from this idea of the black predator that is entirely made up.
We see policing as a relatable entry point to talk about, stereotypes or tropes about black people?
I think that policing is a really big one. Policing is a really big way in. If I were having a conversation with my family, what I would remind them of is that over the years, starting from a place of allowing their understanding of who black people are to be entirely informed by 18 and 19-year-old, often drunk, enlisted men on military payday, to the one that they eventually evolved into, involved them actually getting to know people. That as they started to get to know African Americans who were at work with them, for example, or living in the neighborhood, they started to see that there was much more complexity. And because they themselves had been stereotyped and marginalized in various ways during their lives, they're immediately able to see we're allowing ourselves to look at exceptional circumstances and making that appear to be as if it's the norm, when actually there is no norm. Just as there's no norm within their own experience, there's no norm in general. And so that's one place in. The other is to really just remind people that at one point, in 1965, right, the rate of African-American male participation in the workforce was equal to, in fact, slightly higher than that of white males. And black women were participating in the workforce so much more than white women were. And so the black unemployment rate was actually dramatically lower if you include women, right? Since that time, African-American unemployment has become double that of white people. And that excludes long-term unemployed and people in prisons. And prison is a form of disguised unemployment. A significant number of people who are at the point of their arrest are unemployed or underemployed. So you know, we have to ask ourselves why, you know, why did this happen? You know, and why is it that as unemployment in the African-American community grew, the participation of undocumented workers in our workforce expanded, that the prison boom began, tough on crime policy was invented, the war on drugs and policing regimes were sort of unleashed on black people. Why? You know, was this a way of managing unemployment? You know, these are the kinds of things that for my family, because of their history as laborers and their strong identification as working class people, they can begin to understand. What happens to you when you're excluded from the economy? Well, the idea that then you are policed and put in prison is one that doesn't seem so remote. So we need to start to try to figure out, you know, how to tease out the class experience, right? The class experience of people of color as we are in terms of race,